So that was Polystyrene and the song about the germ-free adolescence song from the 1970s. Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The fuse is lit for World War III in Hong Kong as China decides to impose strict rules against public gatherings once the pandemic is over. So this is from Beijing now. The new national security laws being enacted at this weekend's Chinese Communist Party Congress means criticism of President Xi, as well as failure to respect the flag or national anthem, will be a crime, as will be any discussion of extending democracy or independence for Hong Kong. Many of Hong Kongers are petrified, having seen surprise arrests of many of their pro-democracy leaders during the lockdown. Unprecedented censorship, too, by YouTube this week and social media of expert views on the lockdown. These have been ignored, those views, and the censorship, of course, by the mass media. And we hear from two of them tonight, Dr. Knut Witkowski and Dolores Cahill, both pandemic experts, arguing against the hard lockdown that we've seen in the West. It does seem clear the mass media is complicit in trying to extend the lockdown as much as possible by stifling expert views to the contrary. Also censored has been Max Egan's mind-blowing report with hard evidence that the March 2019 Christchurch mosque massacre was indeed a military operation rather than just a lone wolf. We hear from his report, which YouTube censored. The shooter's manifesto is banned in New Zealand, but there on the title page is the Nazi Black Sun. We hear from Portuguese artist and researcher Aerith Haga. What was the Black Sun and what is it today? Also, Bristol's atomic spy Klaus Fuchs, who leaked the atomic bomb plans to Stalin's Russia in the 1940s. Plus, more incredible evidence that the Nazis got there first with the atom bomb. Classified documents only released 70 years after the war, according to Joseph Farrell. And his book, amazingly enough, also mentions the Black Sun. It's called The Reich of the Black Sun. And finally, tonight, the Zionists who we are not allowed to criticise. That is, links to Satanism and plans for a world government and world religion, allegedly anyway, with another censored person from YouTube. That's James Perloff. One always has to ask the question, I think, with this censorship, are these views dangerous? Are they criminal? Or are they just the views that YouTube don't like? Anyway, Martin, I think we should start really by looking at China particularly and this new legislation that's being brought in by the Chinese Communist Party this weekend.
Well, I mean, obviously tensions between China and the West are the highest that they've ever been really since the 1970s. And of course the hardliners on both sides are banging the drums, and the people of Hong Kong are in the middle. And of course that's going to cause, it's a basic, one of the sources of friction between the superpowers.
But you think, don't you, that the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong is actually funded by the CIA, the Western intelligence services?
Well, I mean, some of them certainly are. There's no doubt about the fact that the West stirs up trouble in Hong Kong for the Chinese. They support those who oppose the Chinese government, and they give them publicity and various material support of various kinds. That doesn't mean that they don't have a case. It doesn't mean that the people of Hong Kong don't have their own views. But they're very much, you know, minnows in a fight between elephants.
These superpowers, I mean, what we're looking really seeing is Hong Kong as a kind of battleground for China and the West to have a little fight in Hong Kong. Now, obviously, the people there are extremely worried, aren't they?
Well, they're right to be worried, because obviously that's going to create problems for them, isn't it? You know, if there was not all the other things going on, you could perhaps see, possibilities of compromise developing. But given the fact that we've got a confrontational situation, I mean, frankly, the Chinese are preparing for war against the West. And the British are sending our ships into the South China Sea to provoke them. And they are preparing to fight us.
See, it's
and
interesting,
I'm afraid
isn't it?
That's the reality of the situation.
I'm reminded of the peace dividend. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, we were all told things were going to get better. you know, a lot of people seeing this pandemic happening were hoping, well, this is going to bring the world together. Actually, it seems to be being used as an excuse to actually ramp up tension between Washington and Beijing.
It is. And of course, fundamentally underlying this is the potential that this is not an accidental set of events. Trump and the Murdoch press in the West are definitely pushing the idea that the virus came from the laboratory in Wuhan, which incidentally does lots and lots of contracts for Western governments. So it would be quite easy for Western governments to infiltrate that laboratory and to basically kick all of this off.
I mean, Martin,
the hardliners in the Communist Party in China are pretty clear that they think this is an attack on China by the West.
Back in the end of January, beginning of February, when this first broke, the story of the virus in Wuhan, we were pointing out that actually it was Israeli-related sources, including the Alex Jones program, that were immediately pointing the finger at the Virology Institute in Wuhan without any real evidence. And we now know almost certainly that this virus was around long before that, both in Britain and the United States France.
Well, I mean, obviously future historians are going to comb over this. But it seems that it may have actually been around for quite a while before it appeared in Wuhan. But anyway, as you will know, there are a number of allegations going on around this. I don't think it's credible that the Chinese would have started this deliberately. It may have leaked from their laboratory, but if it did, it would be an accident. But of course, the Chinese also let it be known that they suspected the military games which were held in Wuhan.
Yeah, OK, but do you think Trump is going to be able to pin it on the Chinese? Are the West going to successfully be able to pin it on the Chinese?
Well, politically, Trump is pushing an open door in the US because they've been basically demonizing the Chinese for years. So it may work for him politically in the US. And of course, Biden, they're talking about him as being Beijing Biden. And of course, major parties in the US are tempted to turn any popular anger that there may be about failures over coronavirus or the economy collapsing onto the Chinese. And the Chinese, of course, from their point of view, are mobilizing their people to say, well, look, you know, the West is the one that's not being reasonable here in all sorts of different ways. And don't forget,
mentioning Biden there. Phone calls between Biden and Ukraine's Poroshenko have been leaked. Details of $1 billion quid pro quo for Hunter Biden to fire the Burisma prosecutor. So this is not really been reported here, but this is incredible. $1 billion to this company and to Hunter Biden in order to get the state prosecutor in Ukraine sacked.
Well, I mean, that's what's been going. Basically, the coup in Ukraine. There's been a court case in Kiev where the Berkut riot police were acquitted because they were able to demonstrate, because they got people testifying on video from Georgia, that the snipers who killed 80 plus people in the Maidan Square were working, they were Georgians working for NATO. So NATO killed all of those people before the start of the coup. And also there's a Dutch intelligence officer, one of the senior people in Dutch intelligence, who's also come out and said, well, the evidence is that there was no missile fired at a plane when MH17 was shot down, which of course means that the other explanation, which is by far the more likely one, it was shot down by a Ukrainian fighter plane. So most of the killing in Ukraine from the get-go has been orchestrated by NATO intelligence services, working of course with the Israelis and the British. So okay, that's what's been going on.
Well, let's get back to Hong Kong and China, because I think, you know, I really feel for people in Hong Kong. They seem to be almost like guinea pigs stuck in the middle, piggy in the middle here. And there was a report on Channel 4 News last night. I think it was by Matt Fry, looking at all the politics behind this. And also then they interviewed the former governor of Hong Kong, Chris Patten, who's also, of course, well, for those that may know, for many years he was a BBC chairman. I mean, he's one of those establishment people that is very difficult to trust, but he was put in that very important position in Hong Kong.
China has proposed a sweeping national security bill for Hong Kong, which will ban acts of treason, sedition, or subversion. A highly controversial measure will be introduced at the People's National Congress when it opens tomorrow in Beijing, and it's almost certain to spark fierce opposition in Hong Kong and abroad. Matt Fry reports.
Hong Kong has been one of the world's star performers in the COVID crisis, despite its proximity to mainland China. It ticked all the right boxes early on, from testing to masks to closing its borders. It took on board all the lessons of the SARS epidemic and has now only lost 4 lives to COVID. You might have thought that this model behaviour could earn it a gold star from its masters in Beijing. You'd be wrong. The Chinese government clearly sees COVID as an opportunity to impose some discipline on a restive stepchild. Tomorrow, the National People's Congress, the Communist Party's compliant parliament, will debate and then pass a national security law for Hong Kong. This is what the law intends to prevent, the kind of mass demonstrations that shook Asia's financial capital and rattled Beijing for much of last year. The law would ban all forms of sedition, subversion and secession, and could be used to end even the most peaceful demonstrations. Hong Kong's mini-constitution, underwritten by Britain, its former colonial masters, requires it to introduce, at some stage, a national security law. So far, it has failed to do so, because when it tried, it sparked the political unrest that culminated in the Umbrella Revolution. But ever since Lev Chow, the Hong Kong Assembly, was defaced by pro-democracy demonstrators last summer, Beijing has been losing hope that the local legislature could pass the law. What's more, there are elections in September, which could result in gains for the pro-democracy parties. So Beijing has seized the opportunity to impose the law directly, thus trampling on the spirit, if not the letter, of the one country, two systems formula. This just a few weeks after the authorities rounded up some of the veterans of the democracy movement and charged them with unlawful assembly. Beijing thinks that COVID has given it a helping hand. Social distancing means that large gatherings are not just banned, but shunned for personal safety. And the eyes of the world may be distracted by the virus, but not the eyes of Donald Trump, who has turned blaming China into his re-election slogan, and who is almost certain to use the law to up the ante in what looks like his new Cold War with Beijing.
Well, I'm joined now from Southwest London by Lord Paton, who was the last British governor of Hong Kong. The Chinese Foreign Ministry has issued quite an attack on you after a recent speech you made, accusing you of sort of stirring up the protest movements, and is, you know, is really critical of you. I mean, saying you're sort of meddling and will go down in history as sort of as just a historical notoriety.
Well, that's no change for me. I used to be described in that sort of way when I was governor of Hong Kong. Then when I was the European Commissioner for External Relations and responsible, among other things, for Chinese accession talks to the WTO, they decided I was a force for concord, not discord. The way the Chinese behave, and this regime in particular, is pretty predictable. If you say what they want you to say, you're a friend of China and they screw you. If you don't say what they want you to say, you're condemned for 1,000 generations. And occasionally, like me, you get remission. But what the hell? This is a frightened lot of bullies. And this is different from previous communist regimes since Mao. This has turned its back on what was happening under Jiang Zemin, Deng Xiaoping's view of one country, two systems. And why? Because they're frightened of delivering the promises that were given to people in Hong Kong. Matt was there during the demonstrations and did some terrific reporting. And he would have told you, I know, that the people who were out on the streets getting on for 2 million weren't terrible radicals. They were ordinary mums and dads. They were young and old, and they were working class and middle class, all who wanted Hong Kong to go on having the rule of law and the sort of freedoms that you associate with an open society. And one of my worries about what's happening is that this will be very damaging for the Hong Kong economy and for its position as an international hub in Asia. This will damage Hong Kong. And I do hope that they will have think again, and that any demonstrations will help them to think again. But I also hope that any demonstrations are peaceful and will avoid violence, whatever the provocation from the police.
So you support the idea of demonstrations over this. I mean, should the British government do anything? Should it raise it at least?
The British government should be the biggest demonstrator. The British government, the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary should make it clear that this is a fundamental breach of the Joint Declaration, which is an international treaty lodged at the UN. They should raise it at the UN. They should raise it with all our friends and colleagues, with Australia, Canada, New Zealand, United States, European countries. It's an example, I'm afraid, of this very simple fact, which we're going to have to live with. You cannot trust Xi Jinping's China. That's different from previous administrations. He tightened up as a dictator. He cannot abide anybody who disagrees with him. And the Chinese government, not only in Hong Kong but elsewhere, are taking advantage of the fact that everybody is concentrating quite properly on fighting the coronavirus. They're taking advantage of that to throw their weight around to hector and to bully. And we must really learn to stand up to them.
Martin, Pompeo has been laying out the case for what he calls Cold War II. For several decades, he says, we thought the regime would become more like us through trade, scientific exchanges, diplomatic outreach. But that didn't happen. He's accused the World Health Organization's director, Tedros Adhanom, of unusually close ties to Beijing, started long before this current pandemic. So it doesn't look as if this is going away. It looks as if tensions between China and the US are just simply on a ratchet now.
Well, that's right. And of course, the people of Hong Kong were relations with China, apart from Hong Kong, on a more even keel, then the Hong Kong situation could be dealt with in a more considered fashion. But they are basically being used as pawns now. Trump is very much encouraging them to protest. And of course, what Trump would really like is for the People's Liberation Army to go into Hong Kong before November. And then he can say, look, we're going to war with China in every possible way you can think of. And of course, the Chinese military are presuming that they're going to have to do that anyway, which is why they're not that bothered about what people like Patton think. They think that they're already in a war with the US and the time has come to actually start fighting properly. And of course, we are sending our ships to the South China Sea to object to what the Chinese are trying to do there. They would say, well, hang on a minute, you try and control the sea around Britain. That's what the Royal Navy's been there for hundreds of years. We're just trying to do the same thing here. And you can't just send your military vessels in our direction in the way that you are. And, of course, the other thing that's going on is the Iranians are sending their tankers across to Venezuela, and that could turn into a shooting match
Martin, that Chris Patton set this problem up in the first place with the deal he did with the Chinese.
Well, what he didn't mention, and what the Chinese would mention, is that when the British ran Hong Kong, there was no democracy, none whatsoever. Now, when the British have left, suddenly they're saying that there should be democracy in Hong Kong.
Yeah, but people weren't shot or arrested or imprisoned or whatever for laughing at the British flag.
No, they weren't. But at the same time, the idea that Britain, what the Chinese think from their point of view, I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm just saying the way they look at it. And don't forget, there's a hell of a lot more Chinese in China than there is in Hong Kong. You know, if there was a vote in the whole of China, they might vote to annex Hong Kong. Is that fair? I don't know.
What about the Chinese system, though? Because we've got almost like, he's like the Pope, isn't he, President Xi? The idea is you're not allowed to criticise him. If you say that he's wrong on something, you can be arrested for it.
Well, he's much more powerful than the Pope then, isn't he?
What I mean is the infallibility of it.
Well, the fact is,
it's almost like a religion.
Well, it's the Chinese Communist Party has got an ideology called Chinese communism, socialism with Chinese characteristics. And their way of looking at the world and the way they organise themselves is rather different from the outside world. And that's been true forever. In actual fact, during the Maoist era, it was far, far more repressive than it is today. I mean, modern China is, relatively speaking, a modernized economy and society, high levels of education, and so on.
Okay, China came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week, where the question of China buying up dying British defense companies came up.
We're now going down to Dorset to Richard Drax. Richard Drax. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Defence Select Committee heard recently that France is conducting a root and branch review of its defence supply chain, following concerns that China is buying up defence-related companies that are going bust during this pandemic. Does my right honourable friend think it might be wise to consider doing the same thing here, in addition to rowing back from his plans to allow Huawei to roll out 5G?
Prime Minister.
I'm sure there's a legal term for the imputing of a policy to me that I've not yet announced by my honourable friend. What I will say is he's absolutely right to be concerned about investment, to be concerned about the buying up of UK technology now by countries may not always may have ulterior motives, and we are certainly bringing forward measures to ensure that we protect our technological base, and I'm happy, and he'll be hearing a lot more about that in the next few weeks.
Well, it's a bit late, isn't it, really? I mean, almost all of our technology over the last 40 years, Martin, has already been bought up by foreign businesses and is being run for foreign shareholders.
Well, that's right. I mean, the philosophy of successive Conservative governments has been to let the market decide. And, of course, now they're deciding, oh, no, we're going to have some kind of strategic planning involved in this, but it's a bit late in the day. I mean, the Chinese, in fact, invest far more in Britain than they do in any other European country. And if we decide to go to war with them literally or just a cold war, then that investment will dry up. And we're talking in the first hour about unemployment in the country and so on. If the Chinese decide to pack up and go elsewhere, that will be one of the implications.
Well, we're going to talk about censorship now, and our sound engineer, Dave Bazanko, sent me this rather shocking report about the censoring of Dolores Cahill, who's a pandemic expert in Ireland, and the way that a journalist from Business Insider actually flagged up the video to YouTube, who then took it down, and then he contacted the Computing Forever, the website, the YouTube channel, saying, well, how do you feel about this being censored? I hope you're okay, that sort of thing. So let's have a listen now to the Computing Forever author, whoever he is, I'm not sure of his name, and the censorship of this actually very important interview with an expert in Ireland over the coronavirus.
I received an email from Martin Coulter of Business Insider that read, "Hey Dave, hope you're keeping safe and well under lockdown." Really? Do you really hope that I'm keeping safe and well under lockdown, Martin? Way to be all two-faced and nicey-nicey to me privately, and then publicly you admit that you flagged my video. I saw your video with Dolores Cahill was removed from Facebook and YouTube. I'll be covering this for Business Insider. Do you have any comment to offer with regards to the tech firm's actions? Please let me know when you can, and I'll be sure to include in our article, in your hit piece, you mean? In your hit piece against me and Dolores Cahill? Thank you, Martin, it says. I'm sorry, this is just absolutely unbelievable. Your tweet says, after we flagged it, suggesting you and or Business Insider flagged the video. Yeah, it was removed after it was flagged by you guys. So are you asking me if I have a comment to offer with regards to the tech firm's actions? Do you want me to give you a comment about how I feel about the fact that you guys actually are the ones who flagged my video? So you basically generated an article about the censoring of my video, which reads, Facebook and YouTube took 7 days to 7 days, unbelievable, to remove an hour-long video filled with COVID-19 conspiracies. Okay, you haven't bothered to address our claims or to see if what we're saying is true or not. You just fob them off as conspiracies, of course. And then when you click on this article, it immediately brings up a paywall. So you flagged my video, contacted me looking for a comment on the video's removal. You didn't tell me in your email that you guys were the ones who flagged it or that you were going to call me hard right, etc. You then proceeded to smear myself and Dolores on Twitter as hard right. You claim that the video contains conspiracies. You erroneously claimed that Dolores never mentioned that she was chair of the Irish Freedom Party, which she did. She said that in the video. You erroneously claimed that the video had 1 million views. It didn't. You then admitted that you guys flagged the video, and then you proceed to place this article of yours behind a paywall, essentially monetizing the censorship of my content. This is absolutely astounding. Totally shameless.
So, Martin, that's the guy that runs Computing Forever YouTube channel. I mean, it's almost like this is a story created by a journalist getting a interview with an expert on COVID-19 removed from the internet.
Well, I mean, I think this whatever. I haven't seen the video, so I don't know why.
We'll hear a bit from it in a minute.
Well, okay, but I mean, the point is that the real issue here is everything that we're talking about in relation to censorship. YouTube is a private company, and just like Rupert Murdoch, they go out and they can say whatever they want. Now, that's not really adequate as a way of protecting freedom of speech, because they're a monopoly because of the way that the technology is developed.
Well, it's also the fact that they're looking for advertisers.
There's no obligation on Murdoch to do anything at all. He can lie, he can cheat. I mean, freedom of speech means freedom to lie. And of course, YouTube is basically exploiting that position that it has. They can decide that they don't like an opinion and they can get rid of it.
Martin, this is really about journalistic ethics. It's almost like the journalist that goes and sets fire to the warehouse in order to make a story about the warehouse being set on fire.
Well, yes, it does. I mean, it certainly raises questions on that front. It certainly does. No doubt about it.
Well, let's have a listen anyway to Professor Dolores Cahill in the YouTube video, which was removed, called Debunking the Narrative.
So I suppose what people should be aware of is that there are, first of all, in all of our bodies, there are hundreds of thousands of different viruses in our bodies. And it's important that for our natural microbiome that we actually come in contact with bacteria and viruses. And so this just shows that every year, we'll say in the Northern Hemisphere, in the winter time, there is a flu season. And the CDC are just showing that this year, from week 48 in December of 2019 to the beginning of April, or the middle of April, the 12th of April, there were three circulating viruses.
Hello, I can't talk now. I'm live on the radio.
The first one was influenza B. The second one was influenza A. And the third one was this COVID-19 virus. And that generally, you know, viruses circulate the globe within about 3 or 4 weeks. And so we've already had three viruses circulating, and COVID-19, this is data from America, was circulating, had its peak on the 22nd of March. And that means that people were probably at peak infection 10 days before, so the 12th of March. And then the population in America cleared the virus, most of them, within 10 days, and then the virus is gone. And so these results were presented on the 17th of April and from the 12th of April. So there is absolutely no need for lockdown. Now, what I'm happy to say is that people in immunology knew that there was actually no need for the original lockdown, because it was well known from China that the 50% of the people were over 80 in China and in Italy and around the world. And there were countries that didn't lock down, like Taiwan and South Korea. This was already in February and March. So we have never in the hundreds of years of infectious diseases quarantined healthy people. Yeah. So because they knew that this affected, so some actually influenza viruses can affect young people, right? But it happens that this one affected elderly people. But what's really shocking, and what I want to publicize, is it's well known in immunology, you can take preventative measures to boost your own immune system, so that even if you were a little bit malnourished or run down, that if you take vitamin D, vitamin C, and zinc, your immune system will be boosted. And also if you eat good nutrition, so that if you come across the virus, you will get it. You will have hardly any symptoms. You will clear the virus, and you will actually contribute to the immune people. So if you were to say to quarantine people for just in their homes, elderly people for a few weeks, then the other 90% of the population would come across the virus. About 80 or 90% of people, if they protect their immune systems, will not have any symptoms. They won't even know they have it. And then the virus will not circulate anymore. so that when the elderly, which could have been the end of April, come out of the quarantine, the virus is actually stopped in its tracks, right? So you can see that when influenza B had cleared the globe from that graph, it's not there anymore. And the reason is that people, the immune system clears this virus, it's gone. And people develop immunity. And it turns out as well, which is very significant, is the first, so this is the severe acute respiratory disease, you know, with SARS-CoV-1 was in 2003. And this is now called, the other name is SARS-CoV-2. So in 2003, that circulated the globe. And they initially started to have a bit of a scare, but the World Health Organization has said that globally, the number of deaths from the first SARS in 2003 globally was 770 deaths. 770 in the world. But what that means, and there has been two more circulating since 2003, and when I looked into it, between 7% and 15% of the global population already had antibodies to these viruses. So that means what Ireland, RTE, and people are calling the number of cases, that even before this COVID-19 came, if you tested people for antibodies, between 7 and 15% of the Irish population would have had antibodies. So in our case, you would have 400,000 people. So what they're reporting is the number of cases of like 400,000 trying to scare people. They're actually people who developed immunity to the last SARS virus, and they would have immunity now. And also for, we'll say, the other 90%, a lot of people might have low level of antibodies, and it's also understood that some blood groups mightn't actually have antibodies in their serum, but actually they don't, the virus doesn't get into their cells, so they haven't developed immune response, but when they see COVID again, they are some of the people that have no symptoms because they don't have the receptor for the virus.
So that's Professor Dolores Cahill, Martin, something we're not allowed to hear, actually, because YouTube took it down and Business Insider did a whole story about why it had been taken down. Let's have a listen now to another one of these that's been taken down, another expert on the virus we're not allowed to hear from. This is Professor Knut Witkowski, and this was filmed by Journeyman Pictures, which is an old-style British production company. They decided they wanted to go around the world and find all sorts of expert opinions, and that was taken down by YouTube too. So let's have a listen to a clip from there.
Contact tracing. So following those who are cases and see what their context is, are things that have always been done to control epidemics, that was very successful also with smallpox. That is a reasonable thing to do, but to say that children should stay at home and can't go to school, that people cannot go out and eat, should not meet, all of these things are not reasonable.
So, Martin, I'd also like to play to you something which we were going to play in the first hour, I didn't have time to, but this is Udo Ulfkotti. His book actually was in German. He confessed to having worked for many years as a German journalist in a national paper for the Central Intelligence Agency. His book is called Prestitutes, and it's now out in English just in the last couple of months. Due to the work of some people from the 9/11 Truth Campaign, the former 9/11 Truth Campaign. The book is called Prestitutes, How the CIA Buys the News. So let's have a listen to the confession of Udo Ulfkotti now.
It is not right what I have done in the past to manipulate people, to make propaganda against Russia, and it is not right what my colleagues do and have done in the past, because they are bribed to betray the people, not only in Germany, all over Europe. The reason writing this book was that I am very fearful of a new war in Europe, and I don't like to have this situation again, because war is never coming from itself. There is always people behind it to push for war. And this is not only politicians, this is journalists too. And I just have written in the book how we have betrayed in the past our readers just to push for war, and because I don't want this anymore. I'm fed up with this propaganda. We live in a banana republic and not in a democratic country where we have press freedom, where we have human rights. If you see the German media, especially my colleagues who day by day write against the Russians, who are in transatlantic organizations and who are supported by the United States to do so, well, people like me, I became honorary citizen of the state of Oklahoma in the United States. Just why? Just because I write pro-American. I wrote pro-American. I was supported by the Central Intelligence Agency, by the CIA. Why? Because I should be pro-American. I'm fed up with it. I don't want to do it anymore. And so I've just written a book not to earn money. No, it will cause a lot of trouble for me, just to give the people in this country, in Germany, in Europe, and all over the world, just to give them a glimpse of a view what goes up behind the closed doors.
Well, thank you, Udolf Ukoti, because Martin, you know, you and I know that he died, didn't he, about 6 months after publishing that book, in rather strange circumstances. He's really talking about groups like the Atlantic Bridge, which they start off as the idea is, oh, you know, if you want better contacts over the other side of the Atlantic, join this little group. All of a sudden, you find yourself as a journalist. As soon as you go against these people, you find yourself out of the profession like he did and possibly dead.
Well, that's right. And that's far more sinister in many ways than having your video taken down on YouTube. The CIA has dominated the mainstream media in the West. The intelligence services in the West are constantly manipulating public opinion through social media and through mainstream media. But most people do not realize how active these organizations actually are.
Okay, the book has now been translated into English. The publisher is, and I'll put a link up to it on our show page, at thisweek.org.uk. It's published by Progressive Press. They were the publishers of Webster Tarpley's excellent book about the September the 11th attacks. So it's Prestitutes Embedded in the Pay of the CIA, A Confession from the Profession by Udo Ufkoti. Well done to Udo for actually having the courage to come out and explain to the public that actually he's been bought and paid for, and effectively he was a prostitute for the American CIA, Martin.
Well, that's right. And of course, we've got similar organizations here, the Integrity Initiative, the Institute for Statecraft. They basically have paid journalists who they basically feed stories to, you know, basically anti-Chinese and anti-Russian stories. That's the usual fodder these days. And most people don't realize that this level of manipulation is going on, but the evidence is there for those who look.
And it is, isn't it? Because it looks like all the expert opinions that are against the prevailing narrative, in other words, anti-China, etc., are just simply stifled. And journalists like me that are trying to do that criticism are also now being, well, I've been removed from the airwaves. I was removed. My career was taken away quite a long time ago, maybe 20 years ago. So I have to do it as a volunteer now. But even that, it seems, is not going to be possible unless Pat Hart from BCFM changes his mind and puts us back on air. We hope very much that he will do that as soon as possible. But also censored, Martin, is rather more sinister, is this Max Egan report from the Christchurch Mosque massacre in 2019. So let's have a listen to part of his censored report. I mean, maybe every week we should just do another bit of whole section on what's been censored this week. And this one's from Max Egan in 2019 on the Christchurch Mosque massacre.
Many of these hits, I suspect, are carried out by trained assassins who are, in fact, MK Ultra victims. And this guy wasn't trained very well. I mean, he was a bit of a klutz. He dropped his entire cache of magazines as soon as he got into the hall, and they scattered all over the hall. He had to keep running back for them and made a lot of mistakes in the way he ran this operation. And that's why we've got so much insight into what's really going on here. But you have to be prepared to look at it with the right eyes and put all of this argument about CGI and all this stuff out of your mind for the moment and just look at what the video is showing you. When he first gets in the car, he drives out of the driveway, and right there on his left is a red car. Remember the woman in red from The Matrix? Red is often used in these MKUltra operations. There's a red car right there on his left as he pulls out. Then he goes out of the driveway, he turns left, and right there as he turns left, there is another red car, indicating that is the way for him to go. And then he gets to this one section where I think there's two red cars and a white car, and he pulls over on the left, and he waits 1 full minute by the side of the road. While he's waiting on the side of the road, a woman, appears to be a woman, wearing tan pants and a red coat, walks up. She's got some tag hanging around her neck, and he gives her a little bit of a signal, a bit of a wave with his fingers. It's kind of a, yeah, I'm your guy, sort of a signal. Like you're out there doing some shady deal in a car park, and you want someone to know that you're the guy they've got to come and give the money to. That's sort of a wave. Just an acknowledgement. And as soon as she gets to the vehicle, he reaches down and he turns on the flashing strobe light on his gun. Then he continues on and he drives down the road. Then when he gets to the block, the mosque is on. The music in the car changes to British Grenadiers, a marching military song. So here he is, now he's marching off to war. And he drives down the road, continues driving down the road, and you find that there's a man standing by a driveway in a full red tracksuit, like he's attending a pit stop or something in a racetrack. He's in full red, red pants, red jacket to let him know that's the driveway he turns into. He turns into the driveway, does a bunch of little shuffles around, does a U-turn at the end of the driveway, comes back out, parks in the driveway, directly pointing towards a red car. As he's doing that, he gives a little thumbs up to a couple of guys, three guys who are walking across the driveway. He gets out of his car. He takes his AR-15 with him. He gets a shotgun out of the back. Then he walks out. He walks along the footpath. As soon as he walks past that car, a red marker becomes visible in the garden on the left. And as soon as he sees that red marker, he begins firing.
So that's Max Egan's censored video, really explaining the very strong evidence that the shooter at the Christchurch mosque massacre was effectively doing a military operation. He was being managed by handlers who were on site, Martin. I mean, this is explosive stuff, really, because the Royal Commission is just looking into this over in New Zealand. We've heard that he has pleaded guilty, so there will be very little of a proper trial to find out and to question him and quiz him and have lots of potential witnesses come forward at the trial to look it deeper into who was helping him.
Well, I mean, we know from the information that we've gathered over many years about the Gladio networks in Western Europe that the Western intelligence services routinely engage in false flag terrorism. So it would be rather surprising if this wasn't a false flag terrorist attack. It's unusual for New Zealand, but of course it's a reminder that wherever you live, whoever you are, the big boys are not going to let you live peacefully. And of course, similar sort of stuff happened with the, I think there's a lot of similarities between this attack and what happened in Norway with Breivik. Breivik didn't act on his own, and I don't suppose this guy acted on his own either. And that's because basically terrorism is orchestrated by Western intelligence services.
Well, the manifesto is also banned in New Zealand, as well as the video. It's even a criminal offence, apparently, for journalists to possess either, which means that it's almost impossible to really commentate on it, unless, I suppose, a journalist is to go abroad to do their research, maybe to Australia or somewhere, and then fly back to New Zealand with the article completed. That's the only way they can legally do it in New Zealand. Well, the idea of this black sun is on the very front of his manifesto, and I wonder what this black sun is. It's certainly, I know, something that was been linked to Satanism and also particularly to the Nazis, but I thought I'd see if I could find someone who's done a bit of research on what it is, and I came across this guy called Arif Hager, who's a Portuguese writer and artist, and here he describes what he believes the black sun is all about.
The black sun symbol appears in the castle during the 20th century, during the 1930s and 1940s renovations and remodulations of the structure of the castle conducted by the Nazis and Heinrich Himmler himself. To be more precise, the symbol appears in the former SS General's Hall, Übergruppen Führerzei. This is highly convenient. The symbol is made of 12 radial so-called Sieg runes, a Nazi recreation of the S rune Suelo. The SS initials are two S runes. Suelo literally means sun. It's a rune that represents the rays of the sun, light, hope, guidance, goal setting, and success. It's directly connected to the sun wheel symbol as a symbol of power and perseverance. You have to take in mind that the black sun clearly has pagan symbols, old ancient symbols of power. But the black sun as a whole isn't a pagan symbol. It's a new symbol created by the Nazis. Sieg runes are runes of victory. And this concept of victory was added to the Suelo rune because of the Nazis. Suelo might not have had anything to do with victory, while to the Nazis, the Sieg runes, which are other runes, was clearly a symbol for victory. So the black sun might have meant to the Nazis a symbol of victory, represented 12 times. The symbol has historically remained prominent in neo-Nazi occult circles. It's frequently used more generally by neo-Nazi far-right white nationalists. This symbol started to be used by some Satanists as well, which might mean that the black sun symbol in more contemporary times gained an association with the phenomenon of the eclipse, which in mythology has been connected with the upcoming end of the world and or with a drastic change approaching.
Well, interesting analysis there by Aris Haga over in Portugal, who's a writer and artist on the Black Sun, Martin. But one of the most interesting things he teases out there is he says that actually historically there's no record of this at all in pagan culture. This is something that was just cooked up in the 30s by the Nazis.
Well, I mean, most tradition is actually modern invention. You know, think of the kilt in Scotland, was basically invented in the 19th century by English romantics. And of course, you know, the idea that you're tapping into some ancient force is quite prevalent.
Actually, the Nazis were very good at that, weren't they? There's quite a lot of their culture, which was just simply myth invented for convenience.
Well, yes. And what you do is you work with what's already there. The generalized hostility towards Jews, for example, becomes sharpened into absolutely brutal killing anti-Semitism. But, of course, they're working with prejudices which go back hundreds of years.
I know Ronald Hutton at Bristol University. I'm not sure if he's still there. He's talked about this whole idea of this kind of remanufacturing of pagan culture, which doesn't really bear any relevance to the reality from history.
Well, I mean, the point is that people are allowed to make up new stuff, aren't they? I mean, you can't stop them. They're going to. And that doesn't, but of course they can't claim credibly that this stuff is really related to ancient beliefs. Ancient beliefs were very, very varied. We know a lot about them and a lot we don't know. But of course modern people want to have ideas as well. And they basically take from the history of humanity, the variety of different things that people have believed, modern people spatch together their own versions.
Well, particularly neo-Nazis creating their kind of neo-Nazi mythos, you know, this idea that what they're doing is somehow been going on throughout history, which is laughable, really, particularly in this case, the symbol of the black sun. But anyway, the black sun, I mean, I suppose, you know, the sun, it's a bit of a tenuous link, I suppose, but the sun is like a hydrogen bomb, the atom bomb. So we're going to talk now a bit more about, we talked about him last week, about Klaus Fuchs. Martin, I think you originally kind of brought him in as an interesting figure in history, but he certainly was. And here we're going to hear from Oxford University physics professor Frank Close, who's written a book on Fuchs, and he gave a talk at Bristol University towards the end of the last year. And this here, he explains how Klaus Fuchs, the originally German, who he fled Germany before the war started, and how he began his atom spying career after Operation Barbarossa when the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union.
He started sending these secrets from the very beginning when he started at Birmingham in May 1941. He continued when he moved across the States in New York. For the year in New York, he passed the secrets on several occasions, and he carried on doing it while he was at Los Alamos. So by the time the bomb was actually used, Stalin knew all about it. And indeed, after the war, Fuchs came back to Harwell, the new nuclear center in Oxfordshire, it was in Berkshire in those days, and was the go-to scientist on Britain's totally secret atomic bomb program of our own. And he continued passing that across to the Soviet Union.
I mean, why did Britain need a bomb? Surely we'd been sharing all our expertise with the United States when it came to the Manhattan Project. Wasn't Britain privy to all of that too? I mean, it seemed a bit strange for Churchill to do a deal with Roosevelt during the war, saying, well, you can develop it over in the United States, without actually guaranteeing that the technology was available and the bombs, if necessary, were available to Britain too.
Well, that is an interesting political story. Yes, Churchill had done a deal with Roosevelt, all verbal. Roosevelt, of course, dies. Truman was the new president.
Ah.
But more important was that the Americans felt that they had paid for it. And the McMahon Act was passed, which basically said that the Americans were going to keep all nuclear know-how to themselves. And even their allies, Britain, were going to be frozen out of information on what took place post-war. The Americans basically wanted to have hegemony over atomic weaponry. That is why Britain had to go it alone.
So that was that was indeed Professor Frank Close there, the author of Trinity, The Treachery and Pursuit of the Most Dangerous Spy in History. That is his spying career that began after the invasion of the Soviet Union, which I suppose he justified, really, Martin, by thinking to himself, well, hang on, we're now in the war with the Russians. I want to make sure that the Russians have got a share of this technology too.
Well, Fuchs was the son of a Protestant pastor. He was a German. He got involved in anti-Nazi politics as a teenager. And he gravitated towards the Communist Party, which was one of the big parties in Germany at the time.
But he got his physics degree.
And it were opposed to the Nazis.
He got his physics degree here in Bristol.
Yeah, well, he then had to flee, and he got involved in nuclear...
Hang on. No, he didn't flee from Bristol. He was...
No, he fled
from
Germany.
Because he was a British citizen, he was exiled to Canada.
Yeah, but, I mean, he was originally German, and he'd come to Britain. But he had communist sympathies, which he obviously managed to hide pretty successfully, because he carried on being promoted to fairly senior positions where he got access to the material which he passed to the Soviets.
So one of the most incredible twists in this tale is the way that the British atomic bomb experts had to actually go and visit Fuchs in prison in order to successfully design their nuclear weapons and hydrogen bomb in the 1950s.
Well, that's right, because, I mean, that's international superpower politics for you.
So let's have another listen to Professor Frank Close, the author of Trinity, The Treachery and Pursuit of the Most Dangerous Spy in History now.
An atomic bomb, although horrible, is limited in what it can do. A hydrogen bomb is limitless. I mean, in principle, the sun is an example of a hydrogen reaction going on, and it's just a matter of how much you can bring together to make it. The hydrogen bomb is ghastly. And yes, by 1946, when he came back from Los Alamos, Fuchs was privy to the beginnings of the ideas on the hydrogen bomb. I found out that indeed he made a patent on a particular technique that was used in the eventual hydrogen bomb. And by 1950, he probably knew as much about the hydrogen bomb as anybody did. At that stage, I should say, nobody knew how to make one work. That was not solved until after Fuchs had been in jail. So Fuchs didn't know anything about the eventual hydrogen bomb, but he certainly was a world expert in some of the early stages that would have been needed. And I do have some evidence that the head of the British atomic program, William Penny, later Lord Penny, visited Fuchs in jail. in order to get information from him about a hydrogen bomb when Britain decided in 52-ish that we were going to develop a hydrogen bomb. And basically, Penny had nobody who knew anything about what a hydrogen bomb was. And so Fuchs, he had to go and consult. I mean, these are so ironical that you couldn't make it up.
So this is amazing, isn't it? So the head of the hydrogen bomb project really was consulting Fuchs whilst he was in jail.
That's indeed the case. So Fuchs was... now look at it from Fuchs's perspective. He has given everything all along. He's confessed. He's helped the British hydrogen bomb project. And then the Brits remove his British citizenship. And so he felt that he had double jeopardy. And so at the end of his jail sentence, he then left Britain and went and lived in East Germany, which is the final irony, because the way I sort of drew the analogy, the Russians must have been laughing, because the person in Britain who knew more than anybody about how to make an atomic and beginnings of hydrogen bomb, we'd banged him up in jail. It was like paying $100 million for a star sent to Ford and then shooting him in the kneecap.
Well, I mean, maybe the British reaction was largely driven by the Americans being so angry at Britain and at Fuchs for leaking all these secrets.
Well, that is certainly true. There was a huge fallout, if that's the right metaphor in this circumstance. But the Americans had cut us off, you know, from atomic know-how in 1946. And we, by 1950, were beginning to show that they couldn't really do something without our help. And a lot of negotiations have been going on for us to get back in bed with them, effectively. And the Fuchs debacle completely put the kibosh on that for some time. I think it was not until the late 50s that things got back on an even keel. So there's a lot of political fallout as a result of the Fuchs affair.
So that's Professor Frank Close from Oxford University Physics Department, who's written this book, Trinity, the Treachery and Pursuit of the Most Dangerous Spy in History, who just happened to get his degree here at Bristol University, Martin.
Yeah, well, I think Fuchs would basically say that he did the right thing, because if he hadn't given the Soviets access to nuclear secrets, it's quite possible that Churchill and Truman would have nuked the USSR. We've now got the documents. They were definitely discussing it. And knowing that the other side had got the bomb basically led to a situation of mutually assured destruction, which supposedly saved us all in the Cold War.
Didn't MacArthur also threaten to use a nuclear bomb in Korea?
Well, he did, yes. I mean, in actual fact, the US has threatened to use nuclear weapons, I believe it's up to 50 times since World War II. And if the other side hadn't had nuclear weapons, they would have done, possibly. So Fuchs would basically say, I don't regret anything. Just as other people, for example, who worked at Bletchley Park, gave the Soviet military the order of battle for the Germans at Kursk because they'd broken the German codes. And the people years later came forward, yes, I told the Russians what the order of battle was so that they would win. And I don't regret it.
So over the last few weeks, we've been following, haven't we? Particularly last week, we did a whole thing on the Nazi atom bomb, effectively evidence now that surfaced that the Nazis, maybe one or even two possible nuclear tests took place, one in October 1944. Anyway, the evidence now has come to light. Basically, official documents, intelligence reports saying that they've got all these interviews with people who witnessed it. But anyway, I thought I'd have another look at that this week. And also because we're looking at various things to do with this Black Sun, this kind of Nazi idea. And Joseph Farrell is the author of a book called Reich of the Black Sun, where he looks at some of these Nazi secrets, the Nazi technology, which was then passed on to mainly to the United States by Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann, at the end of the war, as very important deals done at the close during VE Day. So let's have a listen now to Joseph Farrell, the author of Reich of the Black Sun.
After the war, in the London Daily Telegraph, right after we have dropped the first atom bomb on Hiroshima, the British London Telegraph ran this short little article. Nazis, atom bomb plans, Britain ready a year ago. And the text is reproduced in Reich of the Black Sun. And basically it says that during the period from August to October of 1944, the entire British Isles were under a secret alert to the possibility of the Germans using an atom bomb on Great Britain. In other words, the British were expecting something, and only after the war did they reveal it. At the Nuremberg trials, the Nazi armaments minister, Albert Speer, was asked a question by the chief American prosecutor, Henry Jackson. Quote, "A village, a small village, was provisionally erected with temporary structures, and in it approximately 20,000 Jews were put. By means of this newly invented weapon of destruction, these 20,000 people were eradicated almost instantaneously, and in such a way that there was no trace left of them. That it developed, the explosive developed, temperatures of from 400 degrees to 500 degrees centigrade and destroyed them without leaving any trace at all. Do you know about that experiment?" Speer: "No, and I consider it utterly improbable. If we had such a weapon under preparation, I should have known about it." Unquote. Now, it's interesting that Speer says that, because as I'm going to get into in a moment, most of the super sensitive secret research of the Third Reich was conducted under the auspices and security jurisdiction of the SS. And in fact, toward the end of the war, Speer didn't have knowledge of most of this sensitive stuff. So it's not surprising that he doesn't know about it. But it's interesting to read Jackson's description of how the Germans are testing whatever it is that they're testing. They're building mock cities. They're putting living biological material there, in this case live human beings, to study the effects of this weapon. So clearly, we're dealing with a weapon that is so unusual it requires this kind of testing. It's not a conventional explosive.
Anyway, that's Joseph Farrell there, presentation about his book, The Reich of the Black Sun. I mean, whether that's an atomic bomb, obviously, well, it doesn't seem like it, if it's only 400 degrees to 500 degrees Celsius, Martin, but it is quite feasible, it seems, that the Nazis were quite happy to try these and test these people out, or these weapons out, on live human beings. And some would even point to the US attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki with the atomic weapons as effectively live tests that didn't really need to take place.
Well, I mean, there's a number of things you could pick up there. I mean, obviously the main thread here is that the Nazis had developed nuclear technology, but also, of course, some deal was done by which it was transferred to the Western powers for use on Japan. These are very murky waters, but I think there's pretty clear evidence going back many years that substantial sections of the Nazi secret state were basically taken over by the Western powers, and as NATO was put together in the 1940s and 1950s, plenty of people from the Nazi era were prominent in what developed.
We're going to listen to James Perloff now again. I've sort of discovered him over the last few weeks. And whilst I don't agree with everything he says, I think he has got some interesting insight, particularly into Christian Zionism. And we're going to hear a bit about that now. But Martin, what is it that makes this Christian Zionism so pernicious? I mean, he looks, for example, at, the idea back in the late 1800s that there was a definite attempt to almost preempt the Balfour Declaration, to say, well, there is this whole strain of very well-funded Christianity, this new strain, particularly in the United States and in Britain, that says that the theology is that the Jews must return to Israel. And then all of a sudden, abracadabra, the Balfour Declaration, and in the Second World War, the creation of the Israeli state. I mean, do you think feasible that these sorts of things are arranged, maybe even decades beforehand?
Well, the fact of the matter is, and it's widely understood in mainstream circles, that a lot of the decisions about creation of the State of Israel and the Balfour Declaration were taken by people who had Christian fundamentalist views of one kind or another. Lloyd George was persuaded to support the Balfour Declaration because he'd been brought up on the reading the Old Testament in Welsh as a young man. And everybody thinks that they know the Holy Land because they, Lloyd George himself said, I felt I knew these places better than I knew my own country of North Wales. And I think that the Zionists have exploited this particular strand in Christian thinking. And, it's not really that much of a mystery, that these two strands of thinking have been complementary.
Yeah, Lord Palmerston is another one who was one of the first sort of the idea of the Zionists, and he was certainly doing that, pushing it through the British Empire of his day.
Yeah, I mean, the British Empire is responsible for the creation of the State of Israel. In hour one, Steve was saying, well, what's it got to do with the British, what goes on in the State of Israel? Well, we created the State of Israel 100 years ago by the Balfour Declaration and in 1948, and the people of Palestine lost out as a result of that.
Some would say we were forced to do it by Jewish terrorists.
Well, there were definitely terrorists involved in the creation of the State of Israel, but Ord Wingate, who was the original commander of Brigade 77 in Burma, trained and organised them. And then they went on to kill British soldiers so that they could get their independence. And, of course, that's not really the Board of Deputies of British Jews today regard those people as heroes. But they killed plenty of British military personnel back in the day. They were terrorists, I suppose they were. They would see themselves as freedom fighters. But as you know, there's all sorts of perceptions of these different things throughout history.
So let's have a listen now to James Perloff and his talk about Christian Zionism as something that he's studied pretty carefully. And he's looking at it as a sort of a way to not only to get eventually a potential battle going in the Middle East, possibly even a third world war, but also a new world government and what he says calls a new world religion.
Let's talk about how this fits into the world government scenario. You know, the Bible does talk about the beast governing the world, so he needs a world government. Every government's got a capital. Our capital in America is in Washington, but the capital of the world government is going to be in Jerusalem. Menachem Begin, the first prime minister of Israel, said as much. The Rothschilds have always intended that the center of their world government, their police state, would be Jerusalem. And this is why Theodor Herzl began hosting these Zionist congresses in Switzerland in 1897. And this is why you had the Balfour Declaration of 1917, whereby the British government promised the Zionist Federation, this declaration was specifically addressed to Lord Walter Rothschild, that the British would establish a homeland for Jews in Palestine. This is the beginning of modern Israel and the modern Zionist state. And this is in return for bringing America into the First World War on Britain's side. The official story given the public was it's in return for, I think it was Chaim Weizmann, developing a gunpowder the British could use, but the real deal behind the scenes, and this is affirmed by the Secretary of the Zionist Congress, Samuel Landman, that the real deal was they would bring Woodrow Wilson and the Americans in. And of course, our declaration of war was in 1917, the same year as the Balfour Declaration. So that was the deal. That was the trade-off. That was the quid pro quo. Samuel Untermyer, who we'll be getting into tonight, and of course, Edward Mandelhaus, and the whole Bankster dynasty, Jacob Schiff and all those people. Bernard Baruch, who he appointed, head of the War Industries Board and made hundreds of millions of dollars in war profits for goods that were never delivered to our soldiers on the front, who were making $30 a month. Judge Brandeis was the one who Samuel Untermyer blackmailed Wilson to put in the Supreme Court, like so many people do. And that became really consolidated as a Council of Foreign Relations at the end of World War One, and that before it formalized it. And of course, the councils, which is subject of my book, The Shadows of Power, produced the majority of our secretaries of state, secretaries of defense, CIA directors, and treasury secretaries. But this is the Bankster Committee. These are the guys who formed the Federal Reserve. And they secured all kinds of promises from Woodrow Wilson before he ran for president. And remember, the guy had no political background before he ran, except for 1 year as governor of New Jersey, which is just token, so he'd have some kind of political back. Teddy recruited Teddy Roosevelt to break up the Republicans in 1912 so that Wilson could get elected with a – he got elected with only 42% of the popular vote. But anyway, to bring us back to the New World Order and this idea of Jerusalem and the Zionism taking over, the Zionists, the Rothschilds, knew they could not do this without the consent of the Christian community. And to get the Christians to consent, that's where the Scofield Reference Bible came in. That was its purpose, was to change Christian theology. It was what sold millions of copies. And I want to draw our connections again here. 1917 is the big year of publication. 1917 is the year of the Balfour Declaration. So now in the minds of your Protestant Christian, what's happening? Scofield is saying God has ordained that the Jews must return to Palestine. Oh, well, England has just promised the Jews they'll have a homeland in Palestine the very same year. To the unsuspecting Christian, it would appear that Scofield's Bible was showing things prophetically happen right before their eyes. God's will is happening, and Scofield's Bible is on the money because it shows the events that are happening in the world are actually being are taking place as we see. All these things are happening simultaneously. It's a clever plan. It's not a miracle. It is actually satanic,
yeah.
But it is designed to trick Christians into thinking that it's miraculous and it's God's hand moving these events. And, of course, some people would say, well, God's hand is even moving as evil takes place. But the point being that this is not the will of God being fulfilled. This is a satanic endeavor.
Well, Martin, the obvious comparison, I suppose, is with the creation of ISIS. This idea that you know that ISIS is some kind of prophesied thing in the Quran, and this is actually quite a good way to hook in people who have got some faith, maybe not necessarily that they've checked in and read the Quran or read the Bible, but this seems to be something which is actually much bigger than we realise. These very deliberate attempts to sucker people in order to get them to think that this is but it's based on a particular interpretation. In fact, in this case, a fake interpretation of the Bible and a fake interpretation of the Quran.
Well, I mean, what you've got is a lot of manipulation at every level. You've got manipulation of people who are genuine believers, and you've got manipulation of people on basis of you know, vested interests of one kind and another. The Christian Zionists, incidentally, are generally anti-Semitic. The belief is that the State of Israel must be allowed to exist because it will then provoke the end times, a final showdown. And in the end times, the Jews will either convert to Christianity or they will be eliminated. In other words, it's a basically anti-human ideology. And not very much to do with the chap who made the Sermon on the Mount.
Also, I thought we'd finish off this show by looking at a book by Kevin Gillaly. I mean, his book is called Killing Us Softly. He's for many years he's been talking about depopulation, deliberate programs to depopulate the planet, and vaccines apparently are included in that plan. So let's have a listen now to Kevin Gillaly. We interviewed him in October 2018, about a year and a half ago.
The population in a natural state would double every 20 to 30 years. We cannot survive the next doubling from 7 billion to 14 billion, which would happen in 20 to 30 years. And had they not started to subvert fertility in 1945, we would already be a collapsed civilization. We would have long exceeded 10 billion, which is considered to be the absolute maximum.
This is what the elite think, by the way.
And not even sustainably. So we may be able to feed 10 billion people for a number of years or decades, but not sustainably. We would do it at the cost of all planetary boundaries. We would destroy nature.
Okay, so you've talked about the poison in our foods, which is rather worrying. At least we can check this out, you know, against a list of various chemicals. But what are the other methods?
Vaccines, for instance, which nowadays constitute the new front of the depopulation genocide. Why? Having identified these endocrine disruptors as depopulation poisons, we have forced governments to begin the process of taking them out of the system. So they are reforming the chemical environment, but they're attempting now to substitute these covert chemical methods of depopulation with mandatory vaccination programs. So in other words, with biological methods of depopulation, which is why vaccines are being mandated right, left, and center.
Well, I know in the United States, there's something like 55 vaccines supposed to be injected into every child before the age of five. I don't think most other countries are quite as excessive, but that does seem like a lot.
Yes, in fact, the United States has 75 vaccines. Canada is almost there
well. Last time I looked was a few years ago. I mean, so vaccines, we've got poisons in our food and poisons leaching into our food from the packaging. What else?
And we have GMOs, for instance, which have built-in mechanisms of undermining our fertility and immunity. So, in other words, scientists have designed these GMOs to produce enzymes that are destructive either to our reproductive system or to the immune system. And this is, again, a method that is used throughout the world. It is particularly relevant for the developing world because countries in the developing world cannot pay for this program. This program of controlling population growth is extremely expensive, and Western nations, the wealthy nations, no longer want to foot the bill.
Kevin Galeley there speaking 18 months ago or so to us on this program. His book, Killing Us Softly, looking at vaccines and deliberate depopulation agendas. Now, this is a reason I bring this up, Martin, is because when and if there is a vaccine to the COVID-19, we're looking at something called CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R. And I've seen various reports on the BBC talking about this technology. They call it gene editing technology. So this would not be an Edward Jenner style vaccine like smallpox was. And cowpox, hundreds or so years ago. I'd like to point out a really interesting article about this CRISPR technology used in gene editing vaccines. And it's in a publication called The Atlantic. The headline is "The CRISPR Baby Scandal Gets Worse by the Day." The creation of the world's first gene-edited infants was full of technical errors and ethical blunders. This is from December 2018, not long after we did that interview. And what they're saying is before last week, few people had heard the name of He Jiankui, but on November the 25th, a young Chinese researcher became the center of global firestorm when it emerged he allegedly made the first CRISPR-edited babies, twin girls named Lunu and Nana. Antonio Reglado wrote the story for the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Technology Review, the same, incidentally, same publication that published that amazing article in the middle of March saying we're not going back to normal and explaining what was going to be going on with these lockdowns around the world, almost as if they were being prophetic about it. But what they're saying is that there's many parts of this gene editing technology and the way it's being trialled, which is simply it's not ethical. So first of all, he didn't address an unmet medical need. So they basically were saying was there was no need to do this. This was just experimenting on humans in a rather Dr. Mengele-like fashion. Then he's saying that the gene editing wasn't executed well. So the genes weren't edited properly. So there were a lot of claims made for this gene editing CRISPR software technology, which didn't actually do what they said. And then it also that there are new mutations and it's unclear how they will affect these individuals that were created using this technology. Then there was problems with informed consent. In other words, the parents of these children weren't properly informed about what they were letting themselves in for. And then also the excessive amount of secrecy that he worked under. And a few people knew about his intentions but failed to stop him, even though they should have done according to law. And also he then sought ethical advice about this gene editing program, and then when he got that ethical advice, he then ignored it. So So this is a type of technology, Martin, which is really starting to look very, very unethical. And the idea is that you're experimenting on human beings as well and editing their genes before they're even born.
Well, I'm not an expert, obviously, on this kind of technology. But, of course, there are huge question marks over all of this. As somebody who's trained in economics, I would say that Big Pharma is an oligopoly, which is basically controlling what goes on in this field. And there's an argument for the nationalization of drug production so that it isn't driven by profit motives. And that doesn't mean that bad things wouldn't happen, but at least it wouldn't be driven by the desire. I mean, there's a massive amount of money to be made from anybody who develops a vaccine.
Okay, some of the experts in the field talked about this experiment by He Jiankui from China. What they said, the reaction was swift and negative. Apparently, the CRISPR pioneer, Jennifer Doudna, said she was horrified. NIH, National Institute for Health Director Francis Collins said the experiment was profoundly disturbing. And Julian Savulescu, an ethicist who described these gene editing methods as a moral necessity, in some cases described this particular work on humans as monstrous.
Well, that's right. I mean, obviously, there's potential in this kind of technology for good. I mean, we want people to be trying to find new cures for things. But on the other hand, there's far too much vested interest in it from people who are looking just for a profit. And don't forget, you've also got military applications of all this technology. And you can be quite sure that various militaries are looking into them.
That's right. Biowarfare, potentially.
Indeed. Well, as you know, coming all the way around the houses, there are two competing narratives about COVID-19 being a bioweapon. One coming from the Americans, saying that the Chinese have done this deliberately in order to try and wreck our economy. And the Chinese saying, no, you've done it deliberately to wreck our economy. And of course, don't forget, as I said in the first hour, the international financial system started to crack up in September before coronavirus. So in other words, they've now bailed this all out with massive amounts of money, and it's all covered by coronavirus, and we're doing it because of coronavirus. If it had collapsed without coronavirus, there'd have been big questions asked. Why are we bailing them out again? But of course, because of the coronavirus, everybody thinks that's why they bailed the system out. But they started bailing the system out in the repo market in September. And as we said earlier, it may be that this whole virus developed earlier than in Wuhan. And it may have developed in the United States. It may have come from Fort Detrick by accident or by design. Whitney Webb's latest stuff suggests that it's probably actually they've allowed it to spread. They didn't do test and trace so that they could then have a lockdown. And that's what I think about the lockdown. If you don't do test and trace, you've got to do a lockdown. They didn't do test and trace, so they could have a lockdown. But the thing is, if you don't have a lockdown, if you haven't done test and trace, you're then in a position where you're not in control of the situation. The Chinese are in control of the virus inside their borders. As they go to war, they're going to make sure that all of their ships, for example, are virus-free, whereas it's quite clear that US ships are not virus-free. And this is going to be the terms of trade of this coming confrontation.
Well, one of the things I found so absolutely shocking about this CRISPR, looking into it, I mean, I just came across it first watching something on the BBC about it, was that in the presentation, it was just presented as this wonderful little bit of technology that can go right into your genes, chop them with a pair of scissors, and splice them in a very precise manner. But quite clearly, there's much more to it than that, Martin. And it's certainly quite considering using this technology as they're developing the vaccine for COVID-19.
Well, that is right. And what's happening is that favoured organisations close to Gates have been basically allowed to trial these new experimental vaccines, which are based on DNA, on human subjects, without going through the normal practice of experimenting with animals, because coronavirus is such an emergency that we can't go through the normal procedures for checking whether a vaccine's safe or not. And that is very suspicious, because if they come up with a vaccine very, very quickly and then make it mandatory, you can be pretty certain that they were probably behind the initial attack. But we will have to see.
Well, so CRISPR, would you like to guess what it stands for?
I've no idea.
That's a bit mean, isn't it? It's clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats. But this is the idea is that you get a protein that goes in and starts snipping away at DNA, and that, you know, this is a way of basically creating your own genomes. And this is a kind of
it's not standard vaccine technology, in other words. So in other words, they're rushing this. This is a great opportunity to rush through what was an experimental technology without proper safeguards.
Yeah, I think maybe we'll wind up by saying, I mean, remember back at the end of January, Martin, we reported on this New Delhi University report that said that the COVID-19 virus, the genome that had been circulated around to the virology department at New Delhi University and another Indian Institute as well had a good old look at it, and they said within a few days they believed that it was a man-made, that it couldn't have appeared naturally, and that it had the AIDS and the SARS proteins inserted into basically what was a common cold virus.
Well, let's just think this through logically and not without going on for too long. It could be that it's natural. Let's just accept that as possible. If it has been modified, it could have escaped by accident, either from the Wuhan laboratory or from Fort Detrick, which was closed down in July last year. The Americans have not been very clear about that. Why was Fort Detrick closed down this time last year? And the point I'd make about that is we do know that the anthrax, which was mailed to various decision makers in the US after the 9/11 attacks, definitely came from Fort Detrick. I would say it's pretty 100% a false flag attack, as was the 9/11 attack itself. Now, if you think that these people are capable of carrying out that kind of attack, which they are they capable of using a bioweapon to try and bring down the Chinese economy? Because that's World War III. It's got to happen. It might as well happen now. I think that's definitely an open question. The people say, oh, that's too convoluted. No, it's not. The Americans have been shouting from the rooftops that they want to bring down the Chinese economy. This is what's happened now. They've done it.
And also you've got the Middle East and Hong Kong now as potential powder kegs that could draw in the superpowers into a much wider war.
Well, and also, of course, the other main thing that's happened this week that people need to pay attention to is the number of Iranian tankers which are heading across the Atlantic to Venezuela. And the Americans are saying, and the British are involved in this as well, we've got a frigate out there, we're going to interdict these tankers, which will end up with a shooting war with the Venezuelan Navy. And, of course, the Iranians have said, if you attack our ships, we're going to attack your ships in the Gulf. So get ready for this, people in Britain. Your British ships in the Gulf are going to be attacked if we attack the Iranian ships on the way to Venezuela.
Sounds a little bit like the projection of power by the Royal Navy in medieval times, doesn't it?
Well, no, what it means is that most people in Britain are blissfully unaware that we are being dragged to war by our leaders, who are being dragged to war by the US leaders and by the Israeli leaders. They decide, we just do as they're told.
And it's all rather handy that much of our civil society, pressure groups and things like that, can't even meet because of the lockdown.
Well, indeed. And of course, what I'm suggesting is if this is a bio attack by the West, it's probably failed in terms of what they wanted to do to the Chinese. But what they want to do is also militarize their own society, and it gives them the excuse to do that. I'm not saying that's what's happened, but I think it could be. And the other thing is that just opportunistically, even if this was just a natural virus, it's quite clear that the deep state in the West is determined on a policy of confrontation with both China and Russia.
I mean, if they are determined, it would make a lot of sense, wouldn't it, to get rid of dissenting voices within the Labour Party?
Well, I mean, that's what's been going on. Of course it has. The Israeli embassy are ultimately behind these what's going on with the Labour Party, as we know from the sting that was done by Al Jazeera some years ago, where the Mossad agent openly boasted that that's what they were doing. And anybody who's running the Labour Party who didn't watch that the idea that the Israelis don't try and intervene in our politics is frankly absurd. They do. And of course, the Israeli state is funded by massive amounts of US taxpayer money. That taxpayer money then gets spent on psychological warfare operations against the British state to ensure that we go along with the big plan. And of course, by and large, our own deep state is deeply enmeshed with both other sets of criminals.
Okay, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henley's Steve Smith, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and our sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I am on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend, Sunday evenings at 7 with Danny Lotch. BCFM boss Pat Hart did say our sister show Dialect would be on BCFM every Monday at 10 p.m, but so far it hasn't appeared. We'll hope it does next Monday. We'll be back on FM soon, Pat Hart willing. Do please join us for the politics show at the old time of 5 o'clock, live online next Friday and uploaded as a podcast afterwards. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.